All right.
Thanks, Amy. Thanks for the wonderful introduction. Thanks to the AHA for having me again. I always love this event. It's one of my favorite events that the Brewers Association puts on, and I'm really thrilled to be here. So thanks for coming. I am going to talk India Pale Ale, which is seems to be something that I talk about a lot, so bear with me if I start rambling. But it is a subject near and dear to my heart with the beers that we brew at Stone and with the book and everything. So hopefully you're going to see some slides here that I've presented before, but it's just setting the table for what's coming. And, you know, right now, India Pale Ale, you know, our salespeople at Stone tell me if it's not an India Pale Ale, it's going to sell 30% less than if it's an India Pale Ale with all the special releases we do. So the words or the letters IPA have a lot of significance to people who are buying beer. I remember a few years ago, somebody told me, or I read it somewhere, I don't even remember how I came across this quote, but somebody said India Pale Ale is going to be the next American lager. And meaning that it's going to be everywhere, and everyone's going to brew it. And I'm not sure whether that's a good thing or not. I would, you know, it was kind of exciting to hear and kind of scary too. So, you know, the one thing that I hope never happens is that other beer styles go by the wayside in the wake of the popularity of India Pale Ale. As much as I love India Pale Ale, I do like other beer styles, and I think it makes the industry fun. And makes it fun for everybody who homebrews and everybody who drinks beer. So, but I love IPA, and so that's what I'm going to talk about today. All right. So, what I'm going to do is go through a little bit of history, again, just to kind of set the table for what India Pale Ales are now, and then I'm going to. There's a whole bunch of different subsets of India Pale Ale that have cropped up over the last few years. And I'm going to do basically a slide on each one of them and talk a little bit about perceptions that are changing or perceptions that may not be quite accurate as well. So anyway, I hope you find it fun. We have two beers today that were being poured, and there's no rhyme or reason to this. You know, just grab whatever one you want to try. Just a couple IPAs that we brew at Stone Brewing Company. The first one is Stone Delicious IPA, and this is a pretty traditional West Coast IPA recipe. It's American two-row malt and a little bit of Munich malt, and the hopping in it features a couple of new hop varieties. One is the lemon drop from Steiner, which was used to be known as 01210. And then in the dry hop, we use El Dorado, which is a Yakima hop that we have just fallen in love with. And if you had our 18th anniversary beer last year, we used El Dorado in that as well. And the flavor I get off El Dorado is kind of an herbal lemon character with almost a Starburst lemon candy finish and hints of licorice. I think it's a real unique hop. It's a hop that, you know, when we first started brewing with it, people loved it or hated it, and now I think people are getting accustomed to the flavor of it and really like it. And so we're really excited about this beer. This beer started off as a four-month seasonal for us. We were going to brew it from, or release it from January through April, and it proved to be so popular that we went year-round with it, which often happens with seasonals. So now I am scrambling to try and find more El Dorado hops. The other thing that we do with this beer is we add the Clarity Firm or the Clarex enzyme to the fermenter, and that breaks down proteins that have gluten in them. So the beer is technically a gluten-reduced beer. And our goal with this beer was to make... Hey, you know, not to sound egotistical, but our goal was to make the best gluten-free beer out there. And that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to focus on the beer first and the gluten reduction second. So the beauty about the Clarity Firm is that it really doesn't change the flavor or the appearance of the beer at all. It just breaks down the gluten-containing molecules to a point where they're a little bit less risky for people that have gluten intolerance problems. I'm not going to tell anybody that has gluten intolerance to go drink a bunch of this beer. That's not for me to say. But our experience has been that people that have pretty severe gluten intolerance issues can drink one or two of these without any issues. The Stone Go-To IPA is the second one. This is a beer we came out with last year. It's a session IPA. We had been wanting to brew a session IPA for many, many years. I want to say 5 or 6 years ago, Kelsey McNair won a home brewing contest at Stone, and we brewed a session IPA that we called San Diego County Session IPA or something like that. It was a wonderful beer, and I was pushing and pushing and pushing on Greg to brew one of these, and he always told me no, 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 no. And kind of a funny story, he came into my office about a year and a half ago and said, "Hey, have you ever had Founders All Day IPA?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I've had it many times." And he goes, "We should brew something like that." And I'm like, "God." I was furious with him. But, you know, he goes, "Well, it wasn't time before. Now it's time." So anyway, this beer is one of my personal favorites. It's a brewer who ends up spending 8 to 12 hours at beer events quite often. The idea of a 4.5% beer that's got a ton of hop character is really appealing to me. So hopefully you like it. We do kind of a modified hop bursting technique on this, which is a technique I picked up from home brewers in Jamil. Thank you for that. And this hop, the featured hop in this beer is Mosaic. It's also got a little bit of Citra in the dry hop. All right, so looking at IPA history, and when I wrote the book, I ended up categorizing IPA history into four time periods. And the first period was the Hodgson London Bow Brewery IPA. And Hodgson was the guy who was credited 100 years later with inventing the IPA. And really in the research in the book and talking with historians, it most people think at this point that he really didn't invent anything. He was just brewing a really strong pale ale that did really well when it went to India, and it wasn't a calculated recipe formulation to survive the trip. Unfortunately, there are no records of this beer, and the only thing that people can make assumptions about are based on the advertisements and the write-ups in the old newspapers that you can find in the British Museum or the National Library. And then in the 1800s, the Burton Brewers started getting involved in brewing the India Pale Ale. They had been brewing the Burton Ale, the strong barley wine precursor, for a long time, and they lost a lot of that market due to political problems in Russia, which is where a lot of that beer was going to. And so they were looking for something to brew to stay in business, and some people from the East India Company approached some of the brewers in Burton and asked them to brew something to compete with the Hodgson's beer, because Hodgson was getting a little temperamental and a little bit hard to deal with. And there's a lot of real good documentation on the Burton IPA, and I'll talk about that in just a second. But I think, there's a lot of good information out there on how these beers were brewed. And then in the 1900s, when you had the anti-alcohol movements going on, and that wasn't just in the United States with Prohibition, but it was very strong in other countries as well, coupled with world wars and political issues and taxes, the IPA became a shell of its former self. And in England, it went away almost completely in the United States, and in England, the alcohol content dropped down to 3 to 4%. Which is IPA in name only. It's not really an IPA anymore. And then, of course, what's going on right now, we're in the midst of this huge revolution. Everybody, almost every brewer out there is brewing an IPA of some sort. It's usually the first beer I look for when I go into a brew pub. Although at this point I'm starting to look for pale ales because they're getting harder to find. A lot of people brewing great IPAs out there. So we're going to talk about some of those. So just to kind of refresh your memory, if you sat through one of my talks before, the historical English IPA, this is basically the Burton IPA. This was a very dry and very pale beer. They developed a special low-kilned malt that was very light in color, and it's called extra pale malt or white malt. And you can still find that. There's a couple of English maltsters that are making it, but it's not shipped on a widespread basis to the United States. A comparable malt to that would be Pilsner malt, but not a German Pilsner malt, because that's got too much of that sulfur DMS thing. That's not what this malt's all about. So an American Pilsner malt might be a good substitute. The hops that these brewers used was East Kent Goldings, and that was the favorite hop and the most revered hop of English brewers. And so these brewers would save the East Kent Goldings for their IPA. The IPA was the premium beer that these brewers were making. And so they saved the best ingredients for it. The yeast strains that were used, you know, typical English yeast strains, though back in the 1800s, these cultures that were being maintained by the breweries often had 5 to 7 different actual strains in them. And so what that meant is that the fermentation stopped and started several times during the process, just as different yeasts came into being and grew and started feeding on whatever sugar was left. And then, of course, the water. I think everybody knows about Burton water and how hard it is and how much that accentuates hops and how important that was to the success of the beer, the clarity of the beer. One of the things is the brewers in Burton undersized their kettles so that they could not get a really intense boil. And they were the only, this was the only area that did that. You didn't see that in London or Scotland or anywhere else where they were brewing a lot of IPAs. But in Burton, they had undersized kettles, so their boils were basically a simmer. And the reason for that was they didn't want to develop a lot of color during the boil. All these beers at the time were Partagyle brewed, which means that they did a mash, drew off the wort, a fairly high gravity wort. They weren't sparging. They throw in more hot water into the grain, mash it again, draw off that liquid wort, and maybe do that 3 times. And then they would blend the worts together to get the alcohol strength. So they'd make 2 or 3 beers out of one malt charge. Base and just blend to specific gravities. There are not many people that are doing that Partagyle brewing anymore, but Fuller's in London is the one brewery that is. And if you ever go to London and get a chance to go to Fuller's, I highly recommend it. I think they're fantastic. They've combined tradition with some really innovative stuff. Some neat things about the India Pale Ales from Burton to me. The hopping, 5 to 9 pounds per barrel, that's huge. Right now, the craft brewing industry average is about 1.5 pounds per barrel. At Stone, we're a little bit higher than that just because of the beers that we brew. But 5 to 9 pounds per barrel, that's a massive amount of hops through the brewing process. And, you know, even given the fact that the East Kent Goldings at the time were probably 3% alpha acids, that's a lot of hops. And the other thing that I thought was really interesting, you know, as I did this research, was how much time this beer spent in barrels. And it was 1 to 1.5 years in an oak barrel before it even got shipped to India. And that is totally different than anything we do now. Right now, you know, and Stone is trying to lead the charge on this, but we want people to drink our IPAs fresh. We have a 35-day shelf life IPA out there that is probably the lowest, shortest shelf life of any beer, and we think it's that important. These beers were not that way. They weren't drunk fresh, and a lot of the comments when people drank the beers fresh talked about how harsh they were and how bitter they were, and so this aging period really mellowed the beers out. And it was very important from the aging process. So IPAs back then were brewed in the fall, and they were brewed using the freshest ingredients, and then they were put down in a barrel and cellared over the winter. And then as the summer months came and temperatures warmed up, the brewers would take the bungs out of the barrels and let the fermentation restart again. And it went through a couple of cycles of that, and by the time it was done, it was very dry and really well fermented out, and that helped prevent barrels from exploding on the trip to India, which is how that developed. So this beer was aged for a long period of time, and I honestly believe that there was some Brettanomyces activity in these barrels at some point. All the evidence points to it, although nobody's actually been able to verify it. But the fact that when Carlsberg started doing yeast isolations of British ale yeast, they found Brettanomyces, and that was the discovery of the Brettanomyces yeast, and it's a British thing. So I think the evidence is all there to point to the fact that there was probably some Brettanomyces activity in the Burton brewing process. Okay, talking about barrel aging, this is a illustration of a barrel area in Burton. This is from the Bass Brewery. And just to kind of put this into perspective, the coopers, the people that built the barrels and maintained the barrels, were held at an equal level as to the brewing chemists at the breweries. And there's a famous pub in Burton, if you ever get to go to Burton on Trent, called Cooper's Tavern, that's been there for over 100 years. And it's an homage to the coopers of the British brewers in Burton. This is a chart that's in my book, and I'm not going to go over it in any detail, but what I tried to do here is I went through the GABF style guidelines, BJCP, World Beer Cup, and tried to put together some parameters for all the different types of IPAs that were out there. And then I threw in the historical side of it as well. So it's a nice way to compare and contrast different styles of IPA and different historical styles. So enough said about that. It's a busy chart. So the American Craft IPA, this is exemplified. Anchor Liberty Ale was probably the first one post-Ballantine that made its way out there. And then Sierra Nevada Celebration Ale and Burt Grant's IPA were probably the three main inspirations for most American craft brewers, at least the ones that started in the later 80s. As IPA turned into a big style in the late 80s and early 90s and mid-90s, most of the brewers were brewing these beers using the 4C hops, and that would be Cascade, Chinook, Centennial, and then a little bit later Columbus, when the Columbus came in the picture. But now brewers are expanding beyond that and looking for new hop varieties, and a lot of the IPAs that are out there now are showcasing new varieties, which makes it interesting and keeps it interesting and fun. And I think, you know, one of the reasons that IPA is not going to go the way of fruit beers and other beers that have done this, you know, have done the rapid rise and fall, is the fact that the hop breeding programs in Washington and Oregon are going as strong as they ever have been. And there are new hop varieties coming out every year that are very exciting to brewers and to beer drinkers. So I think that's going to help sustain the popularity of IPA. So I talked about the 4Cs a little bit, and I'm starting to see this more and more brewers brewing what they are calling an old school IPA, and this is an IPA based on a 20-year-old recipe type IPA. And we've done one. When we announced we were going to Richmond, Virginia, Columbus, Ohio was a very close second, and we brewed them an IPA that featured Columbus in the dry hop and sent it only to Columbus. And we were calling it in-house, we were calling it old school IPA. And it's kind of neat to see brewers doing this and re-embracing some of these old hop varieties that are still really wonderful, but have kind of lost favor in the interest of doing new and unique hop varieties. The other thing is, you know, when you talk about IPAs that are being brewed now and the formulation differences between what's being brewed now and what was being brewed 20 years ago, the alcohol contents are a little bit higher. The gravities are a little bit higher, the original gravities. You tend to see higher IBU levels, much higher dry hop rates than what we saw 20 years ago. I've had a conversation with Julian Schrago at Beechwood, and he told me he never hops an IPA at less than, or dry hops an IPA at less than 2 pounds per barrel. That's a that's a ton of hops. That's a lot of hops. And that's, you know, back in the day when I first started brewing IPAs and learned about IPAs, and I was actually at Anheuser-Busch at the time, the standard was kind of, you know, somewhere around a half pound per barrel. And if you started going over that, you were really raising eyebrows. So times have changed, and these beers that are being brewed now are much drier and much more hop showcasing than the beers 20 years ago, which at the time, 20 years ago, people thought they were incredibly hoppy, and they were for the time. People's tastes change, and I think it's a pretty interesting phenomenon. So I get asked this question a lot. What's the difference? What do you see as the difference between East Coast and West Coast IPAs? And, you know, the conventional wisdom and what's been written about in the past talks a lot about how the East Coast IPAs are a little bit more English influenced. They have a little bit better malt balance or increased malt balance, maybe a lower bitterness than the West Coast IPAs. And the West Coast IPAs, I think most people are referring to a lot of the beers that are brewed in San Diego as West Coast IPAs, but they don't have that malt balance. They're definitely a showcase for the hops, and drier. Okay, so whether this is true or not, I didn't know. You know, I mean, when I lived in New England, a lot of the breweries there were very English influenced, and the IPAs were very English influenced. But I'm not sure that held true for the entire East Coast. And this is a chart that I put in the book. When I was writing the book and I was traveling a lot, I still travel a lot, but I gathered a whole bunch of beers from a bunch of different areas. And had our QA department run analysis on them. And really, I couldn't see anything that pointed to any statistical, analytical differences in these beers. There might have been some slightly lower alcohols on the East Coast. But in general, I didn't see a heck of a lot of difference in the analytical parameters of these beers. Not to say that there wasn't flavor differences, but you didn't see it in the analysis. So I've been traveling a lot to Richmond, Virginia, and to the East Coast, and I've talked to a lot of brewers about East Coast IPA, and there's a kind of a growing opinion that the East Coast IPA is evolving into this heady topper style IPA. And what that means is a lot of brewers are brewing IPAs with wheat malt to some extent, not filtering the beer at all, leaving the chill haze and the yeast in it, but hopping it like a West Coast IPA. And it's going to be interesting to see whether this really takes off and becomes its own kind of distinct regional style. And I'm very curious to watch this. A lot of the brewers in the Virginia area are brewing IPAs like this, and I think it's pretty cool, and I'm starting to see it more and more. That said, you know, you go to Ohio, and they're brewing West Coast IPAs there, a lot of them, you know. So I think the whole distinction between East Coast and West Coast has become very muddled, and it'll be interesting to see if it, after everything's kind of come together as it has now, whether it'll start separating itself again. So now to talk about some different IPA styles. The Imperial or Double IPA, I think, you know, everybody in this room is probably pretty familiar with this as a style. It's been around for a long time, since the early 2000s, late 1990s. You know, there were actually Imperial or Double IPAs being brewed in the mid-1990s. Vinny's Blind Pig and Rogue's I Squared Pale Ale are two of the very early ones. But in general, and all this information, I got this information about how these beers were brewed back in 2003. When I judged, it was either GABF or World Beer Cup, and Tom Nickel, who was brewing at OG's at the time, was on the panel, and he just basically, this is the first year that Double IPA was an approved style and was a separate style. And he sat everybody down and just told us all how the San Diego brewers were brewing these beers. And really nothing has changed. It's a pretty high gravity beer, 8 to 10% alcohol. No crystal malts typically. I mean, there are some double IPAs that use small amounts of crystal malts, but not too much. Very dry beer, so typically a low conversion rest temperature and a long time at conversion in the mash. A lot of brewers use sugars like dextrose to boost the alcohol content. And the thing about alcohol, and the reason you don't want these beers to be formulated to be sweet, you know, like using crystal malts and stuff, is that alcohol adds a lot of sweetness to the perception of the beer when it gets at that 8 to 10% level. So you get a lot of body and a lot of perceived sweetness from the alcohol, even though the beer could be very dry. So you don't need to compound that by adding a whole bunch of malts that make the beer sweeter. And that's why brewers were using sugars to try and get the alcohol up a little bit. And the other thing about having a higher alcohol is you tend to extract more hop flavors. So your dry hopping can be a little bit more intense. The hopping 1.5 to 2 pounds per barrel or 22 to 30 grams per gallon. And these beers are typically brewed with multiple hop additions, you know, mash hopping, first word hopping, several hop additions in the kettle, whirlpool, and then dry hop. And some of the best double IPAs out there are dry hop more than once. And the brewers will add the dry hops to the fermenter and then pull them out and add another charge. And that's a really nice technique. You know, when you're running a brewery that's brewing 287,000 barrels a year, that's very impractical. But when you're doing a brew pub or a small brewery, you can get away with it, and it's a really cool thing to do. All right. This is a style that I don't think people have recognized as something that really exists, but I believe it's coming. The triple IPA, and there's been a lot of false starts and a lot of discussion on what this should be, but right now, the way people that are brewing triple IPAs are brewing beers that are over 10% alcohol and well over 100 IBUs. And I list some examples here. We've got one that we're packaging today called Stone Ruin 10 IPA. It was brewed originally 3 years ago for the 10th anniversary of Stone Ruination IPA, which is a double IPA. And, you know, but there's a lot of brewers out there that are brewing these beers. And just one thing I wanted to mention, I was at the Rip Current tasting room on 30th Street a while back, and they had an IPA that was 16% that they were calling a quadruple IPA or a hop wine. And I thought that was kind of cool and different, and, you know, you drink a thimbleful and you're good. And I was talking with Guy at Rip Current about that beer. I said, you know, I had this beer, and I just thought it was amazing. He goes, oh, yeah, we'll never brew that again. But it was pretty fun, you know, and, you know, kudos to them for taking it to that level. The whole extreme beer thing is fun for brewers to play around with. It's not something we want to do all the time, but every once in a while it's fun to really try and get a real gonzo beer out there. Dark IPAs. I like to call them black IPAs. I've said that many times in the past. I don't like the name Cascadian Dark. I don't like American Black Ale. I like black IPA. And I realize that calling a dark beer an India Pale Ale is an oxymoron, but in my opinion, the letters IPA have come to mean much more than a beer that's pale. And it basically what it triggers to people is the hop intensity that they should expect in the beer. And so I've never had a problem with calling a beer a black IPA. I think if you see a black IPA on the menu, you know what you're going to get. You're going to get a black beer that's extremely hoppy, and to me that says it all. The other names to me don't convey that message. So. In any event, so that's me on my soapbox, and I'll get off of it right now. But, you know, there are a lot of really good black IPAs out there, brown IPAs out there. And if you're going to brew those, my advice would be to stay away from the traditional dark malts like the Black Patent, the chocolate, the rose barley that you use in porters and stouts, and go with dehusked malts. I think it's really important. The Carafa is what we used in the Stone Sublimely Self-Righteous Ale, and that was kind of the early favorite among black IPA brewers. Breese came out with a black wheat malt that has no husks, so that you don't get the astringency or the acridness from the roasted husk with a black wheat malt. And we used that in our 15th anniversary IPA, and I know several brewers that use that in their black IPAs. We came across a malt, or actually it's a barley, recently, and this is carried by Brewer Supply Group, and it's from South America, and it's called Pearled Black Barley. And to compare it to Carafa, basically this is a barley kernel that the husk is removed before they roast it. And then they roast it, and then you've got this huskless barley kernel. And it's different from the Carafa because Carafa is dehusked after it's roasted. And because of that, you still tend to get some husk material in the Carafa. Not a lot, but you get some. And the Pearl Black Barley, you don't get any. So we've been playing around with that. We hope to use it to some extent at some point in the future. Black IPAs are a tough sell. You know, they never really took off. And I think in general, and this is me on my soapbox again, but I think people, beer drinkers in general, tend to not gravitate towards black beers or dark beers. And, you know, in any brewer that brews a porter will tell you, they go to a beer festival and people say they don't like beer or they don't like dark beer, and they try the porter and they say, oh, that's wonderful. And that happens to everybody. And it's a visual thing. And I think it's very legit. I wish people would get past it. But I think black IPAs are a tough sell, as fun a style as they are for us to brew. So session IPAs, I talked about that a little bit with the go-to IPA. You know, the big debate, you know, that you see on the internet and you know, beer experts and all this stuff, you know, is people that are deriding the session IPA as just a hoppy pale ale. And I completely disagree with that. And the reason I do is that most of the session IPAs I've tasted have been hopped at hopping rates like Imperial IPAs, or at least IPAs, and just throwing some more hops into a pale ale recipe isn't going to get you this beer. And so I do think it's a separate category. I do think it's a separate style, and it was kind of neat to see in the GABF style guidelines that came out a week or two ago that there is a session IPA category now. You know, and one of the complaints that you hear about session IPAs, most of the brewers charge the same amount for this beer as they charge for their IPA. So the price point, and the problem is that people still buy beer and compare prices with alcohol content factored into that. And the problem is that a session IPA, if you brew it like this with IPA or double IPA hopping, the cost to make that beer is almost the same as it takes to make a double IPA, just because of the hop charge on it. So that's a very hard thing to explain to people, and most people don't buy it. And as such, session IPAs did this, and now they're kind of tanking a little bit. And I hope they stick around. I think they will. I just don't think they're ever going to hit that level of popularity like the regular American IPA. When you're brewing a session IPA, the hardest thing to do is to get some sort of malt balance in it. And there are brewers I know that have made great session beers using a lot of crystal malt, but you got to be very careful with crystal malt because if you use too much, the beer gets sweet and cloying, and the crystal malts start masking the hop flavor, which isn't what you want. And there are brewers that use a fair amount of Carapils malt as well, brewers that will use wheat malt in these beers to try and give it a little more body or a little different body. So there's some things you can do, but, you know, like I was saying earlier, you know, you have all that, the alcohol adds so much body to a beer then when you have a beer that's less than 4.5% alcohol, it's going to be really hard to replicate the body that you'd get in a beer that's 7%. Wheat and rye IPAs. Not much to say here except that, brewing with wheat or rye as part of the base malt will give you a more complex, in my opinion, and interesting malt character to go along with the hops. The risk in brewing rye with rye or wheat is lautering becomes a real issue. And I know if I suggest to our team to brew a rye IPA, they're going to mutiny. We had the first time we brewed with rye at Stone, we had a 24-hour lauter, and it was absolutely horrific. It was one of the worst brewing days we've ever had, and we just could not get any wort flow through that grain bed. It just totally turned into cement. So rye's real tough. Wheat is not as tough as rye, but they both can provide complications. But I like using small amounts, maybe up to 10% in an IPA recipe. I think that makes a really nice beer. So this is one that I was very skeptical about, the whole idea of a coffee IPA. And a couple of years ago, Greg Cook was out at a homebrew contest in Chicago, and he was judging it with the folks from Two Brothers, who at the time owned a distributorship that we were using in Chicago as well. And the beer that won the homebrew contest, we decided we'd brew it at Stone with Two Brothers and the brewers that made the beer. And that was a beer that ended up being called Dayman IPA. And I saw the recipe when the brewer sent me the recipe, and I'm like, and when Greg told me about the beer, I was like, I don't buy it. I don't think it's going to work. I think the flavors are just going to clash, and it's just not going to be a good beer. And happily enough, I was wrong. I was completely wrong. This was one of the best beers we've ever brewed. And what we found, we used Citra hops in the beer, and that citrusy character and the coffee character just combined so well. You had this kind of. It was reminiscent of having a glass of orange juice and a cup of coffee at breakfast. It was kind of like having that dynamic going on, and I thought it really worked. And we'd love to brew a coffee IPA again. If you get a chance to go to the Liberty Station Brewery, our restaurant and small brewery near the airport, Chris Ketchum there brewed a mocha IPA recently that's on tap right now, and it is absolutely phenomenal. It's got cocoa and it's got coffee in it, Citra hops, and it's just absolutely wonderful. When you're adding coffee to beer, there's a lot of different approaches that people take. Most people tend to like to cold steep the coffee so it doesn't get too hot and doesn't boil and get that bitterness and that harshness and acidity that coffee can sometimes develop. We typically, when we brew with coffee, we'll add coffee right after the boil in the whirlpool process, and then we will add more post-fermentation as a cold steep. And that technique really works. But one thing I wanted to point out, we did a beer last year, a coffee milk stout that was a session milk stout. And we added coffee whole beans to the mash. And we got wonderful coffee character off of that beer. And we really didn't develop any of that acidity or bitterness that we were afraid of using that process. The only thing about that is you got to use more than double the amount of coffee to get the same flavor. But it's a nice technique. You don't have to worry about it. A whole coffee bean doesn't hurt your lauter at all. It was a pretty neat technique. So coffee IPAs, I don't know how many people are brewing them, but they're kind of fun to brew. And if you got to pick the right hop variety, though. I do believe that. You go with something citrusy. Don't go with a dank hop or a piney hop. I'm not sure that would work. So here's something that we played around with as well. We did a collaboration beer a few years ago with some brewers from Japan. And this was a beer that was designed to raise money for the victims of the earthquake and tsunami in Japan a few years ago. And we used Japanese green tea, Sencha green tea, in that beer. And we rebrewed it again a few months ago. And it's one of our favorite beers. And It's tea actually works very well in beer, in hoppy beers. And, you know, we played around with the Earl Grey tea that's got bergamot orange flavoring in it. And we've had a lot of luck with tea. And hopefully we'll do some more of this in the coming years. One of the things that you want to be concerned about brewing with tea is whether to add it hot side or cold side. And tea, I think, is even worse than coffee in the astringency that it's going to contribute when you brew it hot. And you got to be very careful with it. With our tea beers, we've always added them cold and just done a cold steep in the beer, and that seems to work really well. We've done a lot of cask beers with flavored teas, you know, like going out to Teavana and buying a selection of really oddly flavored teas and throwing them in beer. And for the most part, they work, and it's kind of fun. So Belgian IPA, this is a style that back in 2007, most people thought was going to really take off, and it never really did. There are pockets of folks that really like this as a style. We've been brewing Stone Cali Belgique IPA now for 7 or 8 years. And, you know, Green Flash does Le Freak, and, you know, there's some really good ones out there. There's two ways that I've seen brewers approach the recipe formulation for this beer. One is to just brew a standard IPA, except ferment it with Belgian yeast, and that's basically what we do with Cali Belgique IPA. We're using American malt and American hops. But the other way to do it, which I've seen brewers do to great success, is to use start with a triple or a Belgian strong Belgian golden recipe and then hop the crap out of it, and that works. So either way, you know, you're going to come up with a nice Belgian IPA. Wit IPA. This is another style that's kind of had a false start and has kind of settled back a little bit. It's not really taken off, but it may gain some legs, you know, with the popularity of beers like Blue Moon and Shock Top, which are basically wit-influenced beers. Say what you will about them, it is turning people on to the wit beer as a style, and a lot of people are moving from those beers into Allagash White and Avery White Rascal, which I think is a wonderful thing. So regardless, though, when you brew a wit IPA, there's two ways to approach it. Brew an IPA, ferment it with wit yeast, and add coriander and orange peel. Or brew a wit and hop the crap out of it. And I think that way works the best, personally, based on what I've done. You know, brewing a wit and using a lot of hops in it. And if you brew wit beers at all and you haven't used chamomile, give it a shot. I think chamomile is a secret ingredient in a really excellent wit beer. India Pale Lager. It's starting to see a lot more of these with brewers that have fermentation capacity to do lagers are starting to do some really nice hoppy lagers. You know, most of the people that brew these brew a standard IPA recipe, except they use Pilsner malt and lager yeast in it. And it gives it a little bit different character, still pretty hop forward. One of the things that I see different people do is change up the hops and maybe not use American hops and use European hops in the beer. And that's kind of nice. And some of you may remember about 10 years ago when Imperial Pils looked like it was going to take off as a style, and it never really did. And that was that beer is very similar. IPA with Brettanomyces. This is something that I'm starting to see a lot of. A lot of homebrewers are doing IPAs with Brettanomyces. Again, you know, there's two ways that I see people do this. One is to do a primary fermentation with Brettanomyces, which if you're running a small brewery or a brewery that only does Brettanomyces beers is pretty easy. But if you're running a big brewery and you're scared to death of bringing Brettanomyces into your KHS bottling line and that kind of thing, you do it the way we did it. And what we did is we brewed a Belgian IPA, took it down to our barrel warehouse where we have a small filler that's a cork and cage filler, and we dosed the beer with Brettanomyces and bottled it and then allow the Brettanomyces to do a secondary fermentation. And that's working really well for us. We kind of patterned it. We were inspired by the research I did for the IPA book and the idea that maybe the British IPAs had some Brettanomyces character in it. But we were also heavily inspired by Duvel from Belgium. And basically that beer is dosed with Brett at bottling and develops real nice character as it ages in the bottle. So that's what we were trying to accomplish. One of the fun things to do with Brettanomyces is try the different strains of yeast in it. And what we do and enjoy after is kind of a cocktail. It's got Bruxellensis and Clausenii and Dre in it. And Dre is a powerhouse. You know, that'll go and go and go. So it's a little dangerous, but you're going to get different flavors off each of those strains. Some of the strains will produce pineapple-type flavors. Some of them will be more focused on the leather and the barnyard character. So it's kind of fun to play around with that. And then some other ingredients that people are using in IPAs. Starting to see some cocoa IPAs out there. Again, you know, I wouldn't think intuitively that chocolate and hops would be a great combination, but it actually works pretty well. We did a beer a few years ago, when we had an AHA membership rally at Stone that we do every year, and we have a home brewers contest. Ryan and Robert won a couple years ago with a coconut IPA. Thing about brewing with coconut in an IPA is you got to use a lot, and you got to use more than what you'd use in like a coconut porter. You know, 4 to 5 pounds per barrel is a ton. We added hot and cold side because we didn't get enough coconut flavor off the hot side addition, so we had to go back and add more. And the one thing that we did with this beer was we tried to use tropical flavored hops in the dry hop, you know, just to give it kind of that tropical feel. So we were using Amarillo and a couple other ones that I forget. They escape me right now, but we definitely tried to focus on the tropical hop character. And then brewing IPA with spices. You know, there's a Elysian's got a great jasmine IPA out there. Coronado did an IPA with hibiscus last year. Mammoth does a good IPA with sage in it. We've done one with lemon verbena. There's a lot of different spices that really actually play well with hops, and it's just something to play around with and give it a shot. Highly recommend going low to start with. When you make these additions, you know, maybe 5 grams per gallon, because you can always add more, and you can't add less. You know, you can't take it back once it's in there. And I think I'm misquoting Emeril there, but that's pretty valid logic and advice. Be very conservative with your spice additions. You can always add more later. Fruit IPA, Sculpin's got the grapefruit Sculpin out there right now. And that's really a wonderful beer. We've done a grapefruit IPA, starting to see IPAs brewed with peaches and berries. You can use, with a peel, citrus peel, you want to make sure that if you use fresh peel, you double the addition amount than what you'd use dry, just because of all the water in the fresh peel. I put some ratios down here, some recommendations for using juice or concentrate. If you're going to add stone fruit or berries, highly recommend you use a puree. And the reason I say that is purees typically are pasteurized, they're clean. You can add them secondary, post-fermentation, and you're not going to have any problems with microbiologically with those additions. Where if you use fresh fruit, you're going to get wild yeast into your beer. Whether that's a good thing or not, that's up to you as a brewer. But if you're trying to make a beer that's consistent batch to batch, you probably want to use puree. Pepper IPAs, habanero IPAs are out there as well. And I don't like pepper beers, but we brew them. To me, I like to go very low on the pepper content and just get hints of heat, but there are some pepper IPAs out there that are pretty strong. And the only thing I'll say about brewing with peppers is you got to be really careful and know your source pepper. Because if you buy peppers in one grocery store or one farmer's market, and then buy the same pepper somewhere else, it's going to be radically different on flavor intensity and heat intensity. So just be aware that you gotta be pretty careful with that. So here's some things I think are coming, and I'm starting to see just in very small pockets that I think might have the potential to grow. Estate IPAs, and what I mean by that are IPAs that are hopped with hops grown at the brewery. Sierra Nevada, of course, is probably the best example of this, but there are several breweries now, craft brewers, that are growing their own hops and using just those hops in a special release IPA, and I think it's kind of cool. Kind of related to that is this whole hop regionalization thing. There are now hop farmers in many states, not just Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, but we're starting to see some pretty significant hop farming in places like Michigan and Virginia and New York State. And, you know, if they're growing Cascade, it's going to be a little different than the Cascade you get from Washington. And I think that's kind of fun, and I think it's kind of cool. So if you're a brewery in one of those areas and you can use their hops, you're going to have something that differentiates your beer from a beer that's brewed with Northwest hops. Whether brewers will continue to IPA-ify other classic beer styles remains to be seen. I kind of think that wave has crested, and really people aren't looking at doing Berliner Weiss IPA or Goza IPAs or anything like that. So, I think hoppy lagers are coming. I think you know, the India Pale Lager is starting to take off. I think there are going to be a lot of brewers brewing really nice hoppy beers that are lagers in the coming years. I think brewers and beer drinkers are really gaining a new appreciation for the Pilsner style and really embracing a good, clean lager, which I think is a wonderful thing. And now that brewers are doing it successfully and making them much better than the lagers that are brewed by the large American brewers, it's starting to take off. Whether we're going to see a lot of barrel-aged IPA in the future, I don't know. Barrel and wood and spirits tend to clash with hops, and so it's a very delicate balance. But I have had some. My recommendation is to just do a small portion of the beer in a barrel, not the whole batch of beer. So, and then just blend it back in. And we did that with a beer recently that came out really nice. And I'm waiting for brewers in Colorado and Washington to do a marijuana IPA. We'll see if that happens, you know. But I'm looking. I'm waiting. So anyway, those are the things that I think are coming. And that pretty much wraps it up. And I'm happy to take any questions.
All right, we do have time for one or two questions. If you'll please step to the microphone, because this is being recorded. And if you don't get a chance to ask your question, maybe you can catch Mitch outside.
Hi, Mitch. So I know that some brewers are choosing now not to advertise the IBUs in their beer because of the difference between measured IBUs and perceived bitterness. Do you think that's still an important measurement that we continue to advertise, and what do you think the future of that is?
I do think the IBU measurement is important just because it's the only way to measure how effective your hopping regime is. It doesn't translate to perceived bitterness, you're right, but it is a measure, and it's the best thing we've got right now. And the problem, you know, of course, is calculated IBUs are going to be a lot higher than your actual IBUs because a lot of the bitterness drops out during fermentation. So, I'm a big believer in running the analysis and making sure that you hit your target. That helps you be consistent with your hop character as well.
I was wondering how much temperature plays a factor in dry hopping.
Yeah, that's a real good question. Temperature and dry hopping. I can tell you what we do. We like to dry hop at about 60 degrees Fahrenheit. We think that you get more hop oil extraction at warmer temperatures, but you don't want to go too warm. And the other reason that we ferment at 72, we chill the beer down to 62, and that helps get our yeast to drop out because we don't want a lot of yeast in our beer when we dry hop it. There are a lot of people that dry hop cold and have great success with it, but you're going to extract the flavors a lot faster warm. You just don't want to go too hot because then you're going to start pulling things out of the hops that you might not want. So my recommendation is 50 to 60 degrees. There are people that do it successfully at many different temperatures, and there actually is a fair amount of research, you know, at the college level, and it's some of the bigger brewers on this and trying to optimize what flavors you pull out of hops at different temperatures. So I'm watching that closely, and it's very interesting to hear these people talk about that.
You mentioned IPL a few times, and I've heard a few IPA brewers ferment American ale yeast very low, like pretty close to 60 degrees, and then cold conditioned even further. How would you compare proper lager yeast to American ale yeast fermented very cold?
Well, I think it depends on the American ale yeast used, but if you're using 001 and fermenting it cold, I think you're gonna get close. I don't think you're going to get the same ester profile or the same sulfur profile off the yeast that you would off a lager yeast, but you know how much of a difference that makes and how important that is, I can't really say. So you know, it's a good way to do it, I think. You know, and we've done a little bit of that too, because we can't brew lagers at our brewery in Escondido. We don't have the fermentation capacity to have a beer in a tank for 35 days or whatever, we've tried doing the cold fermentation. Unfortunately, our ale yeast peters out at 70 degrees, so it doesn't work. We have to use 001 and do it that way.
Good afternoon, sir. You brought up a good point during your seminar about the black IPA, on how it's kind of a gateway beer for some folks. I know, at least for me, it was, being pretty new to craft beer in the last couple years. It was one of the first beers that just kind of, you know, peeled my eyelids back, and I was like, wow, that's a really cool style.
Yeah.
I'm kind of bummed out that your Sublimely Self-Righteous is going away, because that was the one that opened the door for me. And hopefully we'll see it in a couple years, you know,
Thank you.
But I'm just kind of curious why, you know, maybe in your opinion, why that style isn't more popular, because I honestly, it's probably one of my favorites.
Yeah, you know, it's and we've talked to a lot of people since we discontinued Stone Sublimely Self-Righteous, which killed me. I hated it. I hated the fact that we did it. But, you know, the beer wasn't selling. And if you talk to people, they'd be like, they'd be very upset that we killed this beer, that we stopped brewing this beer. And I would always ask them, well, when was the last time you bought it? And they're like, well, it's been a year or 2 years. And I said, that's why. So I don't think, I think the big thing is a black IPA, it can't be a steady diet beer. It can't be a beer you drink all the time. It's a special beer. It's a beer you drink once in a while. And I think that's just the way beer drinkers are. I think the color has something to do with that. And I think just the fact that it's got pretty intense flavors also has something to do with that. So what I'm hoping happens for us and for other brewers is that we continue to brew the black IPA style as maybe a seasonal or special release, and just bring it out once a year and let people buy it then, because that's kind of the buying pattern. You know, people would buy it once a year. So it might make more sense for us to do it that way.
There are some people who think black IPA is just a marketing shtick for a hoppy porter. What is your opinion on that?
Yeah, I feel the same way about that comment as I do about session IPA being a hoppy pale ale. You know, the thing about black IPA, it's not formulated like a porter. You know, if you're using dehusked malt, you're not using any crystal malt, you're not using any chocolate malt in the beer, makes it different. It's more like a hoppy Schwartz beer, in my opinion. And at least that's how I formulated our 11th anniversary, which became Sublimely Self-Righteous. I took a Schwartz beer recipe and then made it an IPA. So I do think it's different, you know. I get people saying that, you know, and people that, you know, think it is a hoppy porter. And certainly there are some really hoppy porters out there. And back in the 1800s, British brewers were brewing East India porters, which were basically porters hopped like IPAs. I do think the black IPA is a little bit different, though.
Can you talk a little bit about the recipe formulation for the anniversary beer? That was the English IPA, which is a pretty unique combination of traditional and newer styles.
Yeah, what we did with that beer is we brought white malt or extra pale malt over from England, and that's all we used is the malt in the beer, so it was all pale malt. And then we used a lot of East Kent Goldings in the beer. And then we threw in some Target hops just because we've really developed a strong like for the UK Target hop. It's got a nice tangerine, earthy character to it. And we were concerned that the East Kent Goldings on its own wouldn't really give us the hop intensity that we do at Stone. And we were, when Steve Wagner and I were in England, we went to the Fuller's Brewery, and John Keeling, who's a brewmaster there, poured us a new beer that they brewed called Bengal Lancer, I think it was, an IPA. And he said, yeah, we used East Kent Goldings and Target in it. And I said, oh, did you use Target for bittering? Because that was my assumption, and that's probably what everybody in this room would think. And he said, no, we used Target in the dry hop. And I'm like, really? And I really liked the beer, and so I kind of lifted that idea from them and that inspiration from them when we formulated the 14th. We also made our water very hard with that beer. We added a lot of mineral salts, magnesium sulfate, calcium chloride, and really tried to make the beer somewhat close to the Burton water.
Okay, guys, that's about all the time we have. I'm super sorry to you two guys.
It's all right.
Maybe you can grab Mitch on the way out. Thank you all for coming, and have a great afternoon.
Thank you.